Good evening and welcome to Je Savais Pas. I'm your host, Esther Tyree. We thank you for tuning in tonight. In the studio with me, I have Philip Gould to talk about his photography and book projects. He's a local artist, musician, born in Massachusetts and raised in California. Welcome, Philip. Thank you for being on the show with us tonight.
Thanks. Good to talk.
Yeah, I always, whenever I say raised in Massachusetts or whatever, I always think of that song, Born in California, Moved to Oklahoma, King Tut.
Oh, well, not quite the same.
I know.
Not quite the same. And I was born in Massachusetts.
Born in Massachusetts and raised in California.
Right. So I moved to California when I was eight.
What part?
San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, I was born in San Diego.
Well, it's the same state, but two different worlds.
Oh, so. I've heard.
Yeah.
And I flew over there on the way west to Japan, but I've never actually been back to San Diego. And
wow.
We moved away pretty early.
Yeah.
Although I remember the name of the street only because of my parents telling me, but I don't know. Anyway, so it's kind of cool. You one of those musicians and artists I love to use as illustrations of having more than one creative expression that they use.
Right.
And today you're talking about your photography.
Sure.
And your book. So take it away, Philip Gould.
The book is called Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls, Past and Present.
Mm-hmm.
I collaborated with Herman Fuselier,
yeah,
who is well known to KARVS listeners with his show on Saturday afternoons called Zydeco Stomp.
Mm-hmm.
Herman has been around a long time, and he actually gets a lot of credit because the original seed of the idea came from him.
Okay.
We were talking, and he was doing an interview for the paper on something, and then after the interview, I said, "Okay, is the interview over?" He said, "Sure." I said, "So, what you been up to lately? I mean, I don't get to talk to you very much. What are you doing these days?" And he said, "Well, you know." And he said, you know, Philip, I've always had this idea to do this book. I'd love to do this book on all these old dance halls that are still standing but are closed and they're kind of slowly deteriorating.
Right.
And I think that would be an interesting concept to look at something that had long passed.
Right, in history.
I gave him one of those looks, you know, semi-hairy eyeball look. And I said,
"Seriously?
Herman, that is amazing. I think that's an awesome idea."
Yeah. Why didn't I think of that?
Well, you know, he and the thing that prompted this idea with him, which I think plays well in the book,
uh-huh,
is that when he was a young boy, his parents went to a place in Opelousas called the Bradford's White Eagle, which was an old R&B club. A lot of acts touring across the country, something called the Chitlin Circuit before integration. And so his parents were very good friends with the owners.
Mm-hmm.
So they would go there and they would bring Herman and his sister, and they would just sit in the living room of the owner's house, who also had, I think, a couple of kids. So they'd all be goofing around watching TV and stuff while all this amazing stuff was going on. And he always remembered that he was kind of drawn to what the music was.
Uh-huh.
And, it just kind of stuck with him. It's like, you know, a memory that always is part of your consciousness. And so we were talking about it, and you know, it worked out really well. We took that idea and ran with it, expanded it a little bit, including clubs that are still active and alive and doing well. But the phenomenon, sadly, over the last 40 years or so, is that all these famous clubs, all these famous Zydeco Cajun dance halls,
mm-hmm,
they, for the most part, they've closed. And there, that whole culture of Saturday night or Sunday afternoon is kind of gone. Now, there's a few that are still open. Smiley's Bayou Club and
uh-oh. Being paged.
Oh, blast the telephone. Smiley's Bayou Club.
Okay.
And
where is that? I've not heard of it.
That's in Erath.
All right.
It's an old place. It was basically a geriatric pickup joint for Cajuns, if you will. I mean, it was like a lot of widowers there. And they came there because their friends were there. And you know, lonely hearts would kind of get together and waltz around the dance floor and all that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one. Obviously, Whiskey River is one.
Right.
Which I think is I love going there. It's nestled up against a levee overlooking the Chaffla Basin.
Yeah.
You walk into the place and you know you're somewhere else. And you walk down this ramp, and it looks like you're walking onto a movie being filmed. I mean, it's just so amazing, just as a setting. And it's, you know, there's always a little haze of smoke, and you can kind of see the band in the background and mm-hmm. all these people doing whatever.
It's interesting that being out way out in Henderson has maintained a clientele and stayed active, where some of the ones that are closer to the city have not. It's always right. fascinating to me how some things stay when they seem to be farther out and outside of the traffic pattern.
Yeah. And to be honest and fair, a lot of places, there are a lot of clubs that have opened up that feature Gino or that feature Wayne Toups or something, mm-hmm. Cowboys or, I mean, there's a whole host of them. They're sort of modern tin buildings. And but you're right in that three of the most active places are in St. Martin Parish.
Mm-hmm.
La Poussière in Brobridge. Also, Pat's Atchafalaya Club mm-hmm. in Henderson. And then Whiskey River, just down the levee there.
Mm-hmm.
I love Pat's. I mean, that's a serious, unreconstructed crowd.
Yeah.
You know, they are definitely St. Martin Parish. You know, very few Lafayette folks wander over there. But it's a great, you know, and it's good for Swamp Pop, and
yeah.
Warren Storm loves to play there, for example.
Neat. So he threw you the idea. You thought it was fabulous. So we just started. Started going around
yeah.
and researching.
Yeah. I was researching my archives to see what images that I had already taken over the mm-hmm. years. You know, the one advantage I had is because I was photographing here since the 70s, the mid 70s. So I went and photographed a lot of these places. So I had images of them that I thought would work quite well.
Okay.
And that really connected us, you know, the it's sort of a double, at least the first section, it's both places that have deteriorated or all but not standing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other shots of people actually in those clubs when they were open and alive. So you kind of had a sense of the spirit of the building as it is, plus a little taste of what the past was like. And so it,
oh, that's a neat contrast.
So it kind of works out. And then it's really not fair to give the impression that perhaps this is all dying.
Right.
Even though, I mean, the dying is a scene, even though that a lot of the clubs have faded from the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But so we also included as a counterbalance, you know, places that were still open. El Cito's, the ones I mentioned before.
Right.
There's a few floating around. And you know, I'm a firm believer in the power of grassroots. And you never know. The moment you say something is dead and extinct, up will pop out of the landscape someplace.
Yep.
And said, whoa, where'd that come from? I said, well, you know, that's just the kind of way things are around here.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, that's, and then, so the premise of the book is both the places that have closed, capturing the spirit of these old places, showing some of the life in them when they were alive and open, or alive, I don't know if alive is the right word, but open.
Thriving, maybe.
Thriving. And then also show some of the places that they're still with us. And it's a bit of a cautionary tale in there that you know, we need to cherish these places
right.
that are still with us because
totally.
The trend has been, you know,
mm-hmm.
Not exactly positive.
Right.
So anyway.
Which is a shame because, you know, talking about his memories, it is such a part of the culture and the past of Lafayette. And
sure.
You know,
yeah.
I guess stemming back to even before the maybe were clubs, people having the back porch dance parties or the barn dances and things and the couchon de lait.
Well, I think that's still pretty prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have Cajun jams all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And which, you know, is, you know, I go to the Blue Moon on Wednesday evenings on Lafayette, and there's a jam session, and people are dancing, or they're drinking, or they're hanging out. Yeah. You know, it's a bit of the gathering of the tribe, sense of community. Mm-hmm. And so that's still there, and that happens in a lot of places. It's just that it doesn't happen as much in these nighttime
joints. In the community,
joints,
in the evenings.
Sunday afternoon. I mean, I'll tell you what, I'm a big fan of Sunday afternoon Cajun dances. I went to one in Erath years ago, mm-hmm. Mother's Day, and the band, I think it was the Touchette Brothers who were playing, mm-hmm. and the it's all nice and fine. Like I said, it's a geriatric kind of place, and I don't know if pickup is the right word, but anyway, and so I'm looking around, and then there at the table next to the band are all the musicians' wives dressed beautifully, wonderful corsages, and they're just sitting there, and they are bored.
Uh-oh.
They are seriously bored. I mean, and this is the kind of boredom that happens after you've been bored for 20 years. It's really, you know, and
the post-boredom boredom.
Oh, and there they were, you know, and
but still going and supporting.
Just, yeah. Well, it's supporting, and it is Mother's Day, and yeah. So the band needs to entertain the people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a tough little dynamic. Anyone who's married to a Cajun musician who is not a musician themselves knows this phenomenon quite mm-hmm. well.
Well, we have a song queued up.
Okay.
That will maybe evoke some feelings or remembrances in people listening of being at these dance clubs.
So, this is Nathan?
Nathan, yep, and the Zydeco Cha-Chas.
Thank you. Wow.
Yeah, that was Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Chas playing Zydeco Cha-Cha.
I remember the first time I saw Nathan, one of the first times, it was in a place called the Double D Club out in the Promised Land, which is on the east side of Bayou Teche in Parks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a community out there. And it was a place called Du Dauphine. It was called Double D, but it was also called Dauphine's.
Uh-huh.
And the owner was a gentleman named, I learned from Dennis Paul Williams, who was his brother on guitar, that his name was Du Dauphine. Wait, Du Donné Dauphine.
Wow.
Which in direct French means God-given prince.
And
he remembered him fondly as somebody who was very supportive and you know, always cooked a cowboy stew at the end.
Yum.
And old Dennis Paul would say, you know, it wasn't the most healthy food to eat, but it sure lifted the spirit.
Absolutely.
And, you know, sadly, that place burned down. And,
I know. It's
time
tragic.
And the elements are not a friend of these places. And so that's the brutal truth.
But you hear that music and you certainly can remember being in the dance halls. And
sure.
There's one on Surrey Street that I've been to a few times before it shut down.
Yeah.
And the name is escaping me. But anyway, so you search the
archives.
You know
how to find it, but you can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
All right.
You search your archives, and how did y'all come up with the format, deciding what goes what where? And
well, I mean, it kind of came up. We let it come up on its own.
Kind of
do
its own
thing. You know,
thing.
You just keep adding material. Does this belong? Does this belong? Does this contribute? And it just it's just almost a natural process.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beauty of projects like this that they take. This one took 5 years part time, and that's the good news, because it takes, you know, the famous Paul Masson ad slug, no wine before it's time. You know,
not familiar with that one.
Well, anyway, it's,
but you're right. I mean, every project, every art has its own timeline.
Right.
And
its own energy and its own direction.
Right.
And it may not be your original direction.
Exactly.
And so you need to just, you launched it.
Yep.
You need to
kind of
respond to
it.
The winds.
There you go. So then it got published.
Yeah. UL Press here in Lafayette.
No, I love it.
An up-and-coming press. It's doing quite well. Thank you very much.
Yep. So you've probably been in photography long enough, and I think we talked about this in our planning session, to move from the dark room to modern technology.
That's an understatement. when I started...
Do explain.
Well, you know, I remember when I was in college, you know, we thought we were cutting edge because we used 35-millimeter film and you know, flashes and all this kind of stuff. And I remember one time a guy came in there who... was what was his name? I can't remember. But he had photographed in the 30s.
Wow.
And he used 4x5 speed graphics.
Mm-hmm.
And he used flash powder, which was basically an explosive that just created this whopping amount of light, because the things were so – film was so slow.
Man.
And it was like – I was thinking, like, this guy is a dinosaur, man. I feel like I'm, you know – really honored to be hearing his firsthand experiences.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm kind of heading in that direction myself, because, you know, I cut my teeth on film, processing, making prints, being in the dark room, all that. And from about 1998 till about 2003 or four, there was just a massive shift away from films, you know, whether it be as transparencies or black and white,
mm-hmm.
towards digital photography for a couple of reasons. One, the quality and the technology got good enough so it was actually viable.
Yeah.
And it also, its potential for, in so many ways, was just undeniable. And I had to face the brutal fact that this was the way to do it. And, you know, it's one count time where you don't regret taking the bargain,
okay.
If you will. The thing about digital photography is every digital photographer knows, or either through painful experiences or just by instincts, is that you have to be – it's all about backup.
Mm-hmm.
Back up here, back it up there. Have it in as many locations as possible, preferably one of them in another offsite location. You know, and theoretically, you'll be okay.
And then keep track of them all.
And it's all, just remember, it's all electronic ions or what have you will, data. So it doesn't exist except, you know, through these programs and stuff.
Right.
And where film, you could go back and look. There's that slide, you know. So it's just a different type of world.
So the other project you mentioned to me is something to do with bridges.
Right.
Explain.
Sometimes I get these crazy ideas. They'll come to me. The Ghost of Good Times book title came to me. Yeah, we should call it Ghost of Good Times. That would be good.
Yeah, that is a really catchy title.
Well, thank you. I think it connotes what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes a title will drive a project. You know, you hear it. And because we came up with this early on, it drove the project. I've got another project that I'm looking at doing that is very different, not only subject matter-wise, but location-wise. And that mm-hmm. is to photograph all the bridges that cross the Mississippi River.
Wow.
And not back it up. Not all of them, because many of them are not worth photographing. But
right.
there are a ton that are just absolutely beautiful.
Well, I bet. And the Mississippi is a long river.
It's about 2,300 miles.
Wow.
As it meanders all the way up or around all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
And we are aware of the bridges in Louisiana. I mean, we, you know, definitely ones between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Maybe we know about the one in St. Francisville, and maybe, you know, a few headed north. But our consciousness of things further up, unless we are into bridges,
mm-hmm.
is pretty limited. So I think it will be an eye-opening book. I think in a way, by focusing on this common element that is universal to the whole river, it will sort of tie together our sense of the river itself. And when I say bridges, what I'm really saying is photographing the river, but through the perspective of the bridges. So that you see them
in
terms of thing. And it's not just architecture, but it's also just the culture and the life around them and
mm-hmm.
all this. And that is very much a portrayal of life on the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is all just evolving in my brain. But I've done some of the photography from New Orleans on up. And, you know, so far so good. The muse has been around several times to give
inspiration and opportunity.
Yeah, so
nice.
It's hard to argue against good fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And when the light suddenly gets really good, or this happens or that happens because you're working on this project, you have to take that seriously. I was over down by the Sunshine Bridge near Donaldsonville,
mm-hmm.
and just going down to the bank, you know, to the actual water's edge. And then suddenly these two dudes show up. They're probably 50. They are somewhere between a cross between hippies and rednecks.
Okay.
And you know, how you doing? Well, you mind if I take a couple pictures of you all fishing? Go ahead, whatever you want. You know, so, and then, you know, one dude puts the line out, and while the other one's setting up, bam, he gets a hit instantly, and he's reeling in, and the other guy goes out in the water, picks it up, and it's a 30-pound catfish.
Whoa.
That he just picks up and walks to the bank, and I capture all this. And, it's just very telling somewhat in terms of the river's bounty and its
mm-hmm.
aliveness, and all underneath the Sunshine Bridge. So.
Wow,
you know, that's
typical
are you of a
capturing memories through photography. You're also capturing memories of experiences,
right?
All the time.
Yeah,
that's
one of the joys of being a photographer. You get to experience
mm-hmm.
the world far more richly than you would if you were just a regular old human being walking about doing their thing. You know, you're in touch with so many different aspects of society and so many parts of the world. One of the things, I used to be a newspaper photographer in Dallas, Texas, and also in New Iberia here. And you'd have an assignment to go do this. Go photograph these people who are suffering from, you know, drug addiction. And the next thing you know, you're going over to some society luncheon or something. And it's just all part of your daily experience.
Uh-huh.
So,
wow.
Anyway.
Black and white. kind of talking about color, black and white, negatives, when you talk about photography and even looking at life is that sort of thing too. Neat. Yeah. So where is someone able to go and find your book?
Well, the book is out of print right now.
Right. I mean,
it's sold out
that.
For Christmas.
That's fantastic.
I'm happy. I think the publisher is happy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think Herman is happy.
Oh, mine does the same thing.
And I've had a lot of people come up and say that they really appreciate this project getting done because mm-hmm. this needed to be encapsulated, this phenomenon, mm-hmm. in a book. So
well, and it's so neat, too, like the picture on the cover, you captured it in the sunset. And sort of, again, the setting sun, this end of this era of right. these Sunday afternoon dances.
Right.
So well, even the cover, the title, the project, yeah. I love how it all ties together.
It's kind of clear what the book's about, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I like the cover on the ghost book is a photograph of the Southern Club, which was a big club from the 40s up through the maybe very early 80s. It was a place, it was a roadhouse kind of place. It had a lot of swamp pop acts. Mm-hmm. Fats played there, you know, Boogie Kings, you name it.
And, wow.
And, but it also came from an era when people would build these wonderfully curved front facades.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just straight out of this sort of Art Deco motif that is prevalent in a lot of buildings from that period. And whenever I see it, I'm a sucker for that. In French, they call it the belle ligne, mm-hmm. the beautiful line.
The beautiful line.
Yeah. And
nice.
So there's a few clubs like that are the same way. So
where is your book available, and when do they expect
well, they
the next printing to
be? Go to Facebook, my Facebook page, or they can go to Barnes & Noble. They can go online to Amazon. It'll be around when it comes back. We're expecting more copies to arrive sometime in mid to late January, so it won't be long.
Well, this show's already aired. I mean, January's already aired when the show comes on.
Well,
so if you're listening to the show, the book's probably there, and I don't know, maybe it'll sell out again. We're waiting
example
for third.
Of Esther's advanced planning. She's way ahead of the curve here. So.
Well, we appreciate you being on the show. And talking to us about photography and your book projects. And you're listening to Je Savais Pas. I'm your host, Esther Tyree. And Philip Gould was explaining to us a little bit about the benefits of Photoshop versus darkroom and the journey of an art project, which I over here and wholeheartedly support and agree and concur. But this program is brought to you each week as a public service of KRVS and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, which joins you in support of public radio for Acadiana. If you're not up at 11:30 p.m., find us on the website, krvs.org, or on FM 88.7. And I usually go out with my guitar concerto, but we're going to listen to another Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Cha's song. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.
When things don't always go like you want, when things move on, and you don't, when trouble comes.
KRVS is licensed to the University of Louisiana at Lafayette by the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. We operate on an assigned frequency of 88.7 megahertz with an effective radiated power of 100,000 watts. KRVS is also authorized to operate Aural Studio Transmitter Links WHB 300 and WLJ 739 on a frequency of 946 megahertz. KRVS studios are located